total cases, both confirmed and probable, 3,771. Ector County negative, 16,881 out of 20,880 tested, with 228 pending, 59 deaths. Recovered, 2,972. Active, 740. Midland County, 2,846 confirmed cases with 53 deaths. And looking at the Texas numbers from the Texas Tribune, hospitalizations continue falling as Texas reaches 10,000 deaths. 6,200 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 17th, 1,104 less than a week ago. They occupy 11.3% of hospital beds. 2,713 new cases were reported on August 17th. There were 38,002 molecular tests reported on August 16th. That made the positivity rate 11.9%. 10,034 Texans have died as of August 17th. 51 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,544 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $42.54. That's down 35 cents. First, we'll look at coronavirus briefs. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, one of the largest schools to insist on holding in-person classes, is switching to an entirely remote model for undergraduates after just 1 week. Clusters of novel coronavirus cases had been reported in a fraternity house and several residence halls. Texas on Monday became the fourth U.S. state to record more than 10,000 coronavirus deaths, according to data tracked and analyzed by the Washington Post. The Senate will hold a hearing Friday with Postmaster General Louis DeJoy on the U.S. Postal Service's vote-by-mail financial requirements as fears about mail delays grow. Two Utah fur farms have seen the first U.S. coronavirus cases detected in minks, according to the Agriculture Department. Dutch research suggests they may be able to transmit it to humans, although the science remains unsettled. As many companies look to remote work even beyond the pandemic, Amazon said it would double down on office-based work, adding some 3,500 jobs in new office space across a number of locations. The company expects an eventual return to its offices. The U.S. coronavirus death toll is projected to reach nearly 189,000 by September 5th, according to the CDC's ensemble forecast. And now here are the slightly longer articles. Dog studies aim to develop a quicker, more accurate test for coronavirus. Blaze, a black Labrador, is one of nine dogs enrolled in a University of Pennsylvania study into whether dogs can detect a distinct smell in people infected with the novel coronavirus. His triumph, selecting a can containing urine from a hospitalized coronavirus-positive patient over an array of potentially confusing alternatives, is a key step in a training process that may one day allow dogs to pick out infected individuals, including those who are asymptomatic, in nursing homes, businesses, and airports, potentially screening as many as 250 people an hour. The study's success also marks an advance in the evolving field of olfactory disease detection, the concept that many human illnesses, including emerging diseases, are characterized by distinct odor prints that can be identified by both dogs and artificial noses, which could be quicker, less invasive, and more accurate than the current forms of clinical testing. Young people are increasingly spreading coronavirus. Young people are behind a growing number of new coronavirus cases, the World Health Organization said Tuesday, adding that many of those infected were not aware that they had contracted the virus. According to Johns Hopkins University, there are at least 21.9 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus worldwide and more than 774,000 deaths. Takeshi Kasai, the WHO Western Pacific Regional Director, said during a virtual briefing that the epidemic is changing, adding that people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s are increasingly driving the spread of the coronavirus. Kasai said that because many carriers of the virus are asymptomatic, there is a heightened risk of vulnerable groups being affected. What we are observing is not simply a resurgence. We believe it's a signal that we have entered a new phase of pandemic in the Asia-Pacific, he said, according to Reuters. With many countries attempting to return to a sense of normalcy and to rebuild their shattered economies after months of stringent lockdown measures, some health experts have expressed concern that reopening bars, pubs, and nightclubs will only facilitate further transmission. Italy and Spain decided to close nightclubs in recent days amid a rise in infection levels among young Europeans, as footage in Dublin went viral showing young people dancing maskless close to one another and drinking from the same bottle of alcohol. On Monday, the Balearic government said it was banning pool parties in Ibiza and Majorca, along with party boats, both of which are popular with young people and tourists. The ban comes amid a wave of new infections in Spain. Malta also said it is closing bars and nightclubs. In recent months, younger Americans have continued to drive record outbreaks in several states, prompting health officials to urge members of that demographic group to wear masks and take the disease more seriously, or risk transmitting it to someone else who may experience more severe symptoms. Fauci says COVID-19's long-term effects, especially in young people, are really troublesome. The top infectious disease doctor in the U.S., Dr. Anthony Fauci, said Monday, "We'd better be careful when we say young people who don't wind up in the hospital are fine. Let them get infected. It's okay." No, it's not okay. In individuals who are young and otherwise healthy, who don't require hospitalization, but do get sick and symptomatic enough to be in bed for a week or two or three, and then get better, they clear the virus. They have residual symptoms for weeks and sometimes months, he said during an American Society for Microbiology briefing. Fauci said subsequent checkups show that many have a substantially high proportion of cardiovascular abnormalities, evidence of myocarditis by MRI and PET scans, evidence of emerging cardiomyopathies. He said this is really troublesome because it is evolving on a day-by-day basis. These are people that supposedly recovered from COVID-19, Fauci said. I'll guarantee you, if we have this coronavirus again, 6 months to a year from now, we'll be reviewing the literature about talking about the long-term deleterious effects of non-hospitalized patients, Fauci said. Saliva tests are important, and the technique may work well for surveillance testing, official says. Saliva tests are really important, and the way they work makes them more amenable to surveillance testing, said Admiral Brett Geurer, the White House coronavirus testing coordinator, on Good Morning America on Tuesday. I think it's really important, he said. Geurer noted some saliva tests, like Saliva Direct, which recently received emergency use authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and another in the works, don't need swabs, don't need special transport media, and don't need some of the chemical agents used in other tests. So it skips many steps up front, so it makes it much more amenable to be used as a surveillance tool, like in schools or universities, he said. And it also preserves some of the agents that are relatively scarce. Hura said that more saliva tests will be available soon. Flu and maybe other viruses can spread via dust, study indicates. Influenza and possibly other viruses, such as coronavirus, can be carried on little particles of dust that float in the air, researchers reported Tuesday. Studies using guinea pigs showed the animals could infect one another via virus painted onto their fur. Plus, tissues soaked with virus and allowed to dry out could send off potentially infectious particles when they were crumpled, researchers from the University of California, Davis, and Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai reported in the journal Nature Communications. These results show that dried influenza virus remains viable in the environment, on materials like paper tissues, and on the bodies of living animals, long enough to be aerosolized on non-respiratory dust particles that can transmit infection through the air to new mammalian hosts, the team wrote. It's known that viruses can spread in tiny droplets of saliva and mucus known as aerosols. They can also spread from surfaces in a process known as fomite transmission. The researchers say their findings that the viruses can sometimes spread on specks of floating fiber, animal dander, and dust indicate a new method. We call these virus-contaminated dust particles aerosolized fomites to differentiate them from not only virus-laden respiratory droplets that are inhaled, coughed, or sneezed into the air by an infectious person or animal, but also from the macroscopic virus-contaminated objects that are traditionally thought of as fomites, they wrote. It's really shocking to most virologists and epidemiologists that airborne dust, rather than expiratory droplets, can carry influenza virus capable of infecting animals, chemical engineer William Ristepart of UC Davis, who helped lead the research, said in a statement. Transmission via dust opens up whole new areas of investigation and has profound implications for how we interpret laboratory experiments, as well as epidemiological investigations or outbreaks. Wider implications say the findings don't necessarily apply to humans, but the possibility should be tested, the researcher said. Plus, there are obvious implications for coronavirus, which, like flu, is a respiratory virus. During the COVID-19 pandemic in China, air sampling in various hospital locations found the highest airborne genome counts of SARS-CoV-2 in rooms where healthcare workers doffed their personal protective equipment, hinting that the virus was possibly being aerosolized from contaminated clothing as it was removed, they wrote. In light of our experiments, we conclude that the contribution of aerosolized fomites to respiratory virus transmission in both human and animal models requires further scientific consideration and rigorous investigation. Faster tests and robust immune response could help curb the pandemic, experts say. Faster tests, combined with a robust immune response against COVID-19, could soon mean a slower spread, researchers said. Tests have been delayed and in short supply as the United States surpassed 5.4 million cases, leaving many uncertain about their risk of spreading the virus. And as researchers rush to develop vaccines, they've had little evidence to tell if antibodies that protect against COVID-19 last long enough to get the virus under control. But developments from researchers Monday brought optimistic outlooks to both fronts. Faster testing. Saliva Direct, a test that does not require specialized supplies and can deliver results in under 3 hours, could be available to the public in a matter of weeks, according to Anne Wiley, an epidemiologist at Yale School of Public Health, who was part of the team responsible for the protocol. On immunity. Though many are in the early stages and have not been peer-reviewed, a research batch of studies show that humans have a robust immune response to coronavirus that could provide evidence that a vaccine may protect the public for more than just a short period of time, said Dr. Ian Lipkin, director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. This is very good news, and it's optimistic, said Lipkin. You know, it is a bit of blue sky that we've been looking for. How long that protection lasts is still unclear, but the studies indicate it could last for months. As schools reopen across the U.S., teachers are exploring holding classes outdoors. When students return to Augustana University in South Dakota this month, they'll find a campus transformed by COVID-19. Masks are required outside of dorm rooms. Fall sports are delayed. Many courses will be a hybrid of virtual offerings and in-person, in-classroom time. But one professor will be holding class outdoors as long as possible. I will be teaching my environmental studies class outside whenever the weather is non-lethal, said David O'Hara, a professor who is also the university's director of sustainability. Now, as educators return to work amid the pandemic, that decision seems prescient. That's because scientists believe that transmission of COVID-19 is far less likely outdoors than indoors. Maintaining physical distance can be easier outside, and infected droplets dispel more quickly in fresh air. The sun and wind, studies have suggested, may help reduce the presence of viable viruses on surfaces. Some educators are asking if bringing students outside is a feasible way to safely hold in-person classes, which the American Academy of Pediatrics said are important for students' academic progress, mental health, safety, and sociological development. Even the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has suggested that school administrators consider repurposing outdoor space for teaching. Researchers hope this old-fashioned treatment will work for coronavirus. The U.S.-based company Plasma Technologies LLC has signed a $750,000 contract with the Department of Defense to develop scaled-up COVID-19 convalescent plasma technologies, the DoD announced Monday. It's the latest development in the effort to use a 19th-century treatment to help 21st-century patients. The contract is to develop a new convalescent blood plasma process that makes more serum-derived products and faster. What is the treatment? Convalescent plasma is a treatment created out of blood from people who have recovered from an infection, such as COVID-19. Plasma is the liquid portion of blood containing immune cells and antibodies, proteins the body makes to fight infection. The plasma can be infused into a sick person to help recovery. Since the Victorian era, doctors have used this treatment to fight severe cases of the flu. The treatment has also shown success with two other deadly coronaviruses, MERS and SARS. Does it work? Nearly 67,000 people have been infused with the treatment, and nearly 14,000 physicians are using it, according to uscovidplasma.org. But it's still not clear if it works. Early on, a handful of small studies in China looked promising. Several studies are still underway. Absent other treatments for COVID-19, doctors in the U.S. have opted to use the treatment as it was still being studied. FDA issues warning letter to companies selling fake coronavirus treatments and cures. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration sent a warning letter to a website for marketing colloidal silver products as a cure for the coronavirus. The Silver Guy, which is also part of an Amazon marketing program or Amazon Associates program, is accused of selling fraudulent COVID-19 related products, the FDA said Monday. It gave the company 48 hours to correct the violations. The FDA determined that colloidal silver products sold by Silver Guy fall under the category of an unapproved new drug and a misbranded drug, a violation of Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The company's claims. The company claimed on its website and product pages that colloidal silver, which contains tiny bits of silver in a liquid, can be atomized using a humidifier, then breathed in to line the lungs and inhibit the virus from replicating too quickly. The Silver Guy also claimed on its website that silver particles may reduce your body's overreaction to the virus and can disable coronaviruses. Fact check. None of these statements are true. In fact, the National Institutes of Health warns that colloidal silver can pose a danger to people's health and can cause serious side effects, including argyria, a usually permanent bluish-gray discoloration of the skin. There is currently no cure or vaccine for COVID-19. Now here's an article from the Daily Beast. Texas just hit 10,000 COVID deaths and it's flying blind. Last week, Texas hit the grim milestone of 10,000 COVID-19 deaths. That is, it did if you went by local news outlets and the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Research Center. The Texas Department of State Health Services didn't report a similar figure until around 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday. That small, seemingly modest inconsistency might be easily brushed off, especially in the context of divergent COVID-19 stats across the country, if it weren't for the fact that the state has endured weeks of data woes sowing distrust across Texas. State officials have blamed coding errors, system upgrades, backlogs, changes in methodology, and closures of testing centers for a recent surge of red flags in its coronavirus stats. Regardless of the cause, the deluge of questions about figures ranging from infection rates to total deaths have made it difficult to get a clear picture of what's happening in the virus-ravaged state, public health officials told the Daily Beast. That would be concerning in its own right, but it's especially glaring given the state is using that data to make decisions about reopening schools and other facilities as summer turns to fall. There's a fog around Texas right now as to what's actually going on, said David Rubin, director of Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, whose COVID-19 models have played a role in White House policymaking. Things are kind of messy. It's not making sense, Dr. David Lakey, Vice Chancellor for Health Affairs and Chief Medical Officer at the University of Texas System, and a member of the Texas Medical Association COVID-19 Task Force, told the Daily Beast of the state's positivity rates last week. Positivity rates reflect the proportion of tests that come back COVID-19 positive out of the total number performed. It's an indicator, experts generally agree, for whether enough tests are being performed to paint a complete picture of a region's caseload, as well as, more obviously, how widespread the infection is. As of Monday, Texas had 555,394 cumulative cases of the virus, according to Johns Hopkins data, and a positivity rate over the past week of 12.95%. But as Lakey explained it, things got weird around July 27th, when the state changed its method for reporting deaths rather than infections. Specifically, that responsibility went from one that was placed on local health departments to a tally based on death certificates. More than 400 previously unreported deaths were added to the total death toll in that single day. All of a sudden, it looked like deaths skyrocketed, Lakey told the Daily Beast. Days later, according to the Texas Tribune, an automation error caused approximately 225 deaths to be incorrectly added to the overall state tally. They were later removed after a quality check on the information revealed that COVID-19 was not the direct cause of those deaths. But as soon as those discrepancies were explained and began to even out following the shift in reporting, another equally disturbing one started to arise. An early August upgrade increased the Texas Department of State Health Services capacity from 48,000 to more than 100,000 electronically submitted test results per day, a spokeswoman told the Tribune. Last week, the seven-day positivity rate suddenly climbed up dramatically to around 25% on average in the week ending August 11th. For comparison, positivity rates in New York State have hovered below 1% in recent days. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said in May that if the state's positivity rate went over 10%, it would be considered a red flag. That red flag has been present every single day since late June. Even so, local and state experts on the ground told the Daily Beast last week that the actual information coming out of hospitals all over the state seemed to clash with such enormous positivity rates. Those findings were bolstered by national experts who said the rates seemed out of line with hospitalization numbers. Meanwhile, the number of COVID-19 tests reported in Texas jumped by 124,693 in a single day on Thursday, August 13th, after declining over the previous days, according to the Texas Tribune. A spokesperson for the Texas Department of State Health Services told the news site that the jump was the result of coding errors and a system upgrade, as well as backlogs at labs that could not be added until the errors were corrected. Before the pandemic, about 1,200 lab results per day were sent to the Department of State Health Services, but that has increased dramatically. Now the data comes in much larger quantities from labs all over the state, which is sorted according to its format, including faxes and electronic records, and then uploaded into the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Electronic Disease Surveillance System. By Sunday, experts told the Daily Beast that Texas's positive test rate seemed to be looking more credible as it had dropped down to 11.25% after a fourth straight day of decline, according to a Houston Chronicle analysis of state data. As these issues arose, the data changed in one other likely related way. The number of reported tests went down, which Abbott has said he would investigate. The governor has since noted that a possible explanation for the drop was the closure of temporary testing sites, which were opened in July to help handle hotspots. Others have noted a drop in demand for diagnostic tests, a claim seemingly bolstered by the state health department's claims to the Tribune that community testing sites have plenty of capacity and few, if any, lines. In another twist, a coding error by Walgreens Pharmacy led to an undercount of about 59,000 coronavirus test results across the state, KVUE-TV reported. Diana Feit, president of the Texas Medical Association and an emergency physician based in Houston, explained that what keeps a positivity rate high is when most people going in for tests are doing so because they're sick. A lower positivity rate would only be observed once enough people are going in for tests that more of them come back negative. But with current testing capacities in the state, you just can't practically do that right now, said Feit. And though to her mind that 11.25% makes more sense, she still can't really say how accurate it is. Those fluctuations, which Feit acknowledged were confusing, even to professionals, have raised concern about Texas's ability to track, let alone handle, the spread of the virus as schools make crucial reopening decisions in cities from Houston to San Antonio this week. Big changes in the numbers, said Feit, make everybody not trust anything. Neither Governor Abbott's office nor the Texas Department of State Health Services responded to requests for comment from the Daily Beast, but the latter told CNBC last week that it was looking into the situation and has reached out to clinical labs and statewide healthcare associations. We are looking into why the number of lab tests reported to DSHS has been trending lower over the past few days, Lindsay Rosales, a spokesperson, told the news site. We are closely analyzing our data to uncover any anomalies. So what do experts tell school boards or counties or the average Texan trying to make decisions about their children's safety? Without really good data, it's going to be hard to navigate and know where we are in the response, Lakey said. If you don't know that you can trust that positivity rate and trust the case counts, then you're flying blind. Still, according to Feit, the answer in the interim is the same as it always was. Pay attention to the broad trends instead of the specific numbers. Look at all the metrics together instead of relying on just one. And be cautious. Whatever the positivity rate, said Feit, people who are at risk, who have chronic illnesses or elderly, need to stay quarantined. No matter what, it's still out there, she added. And now here's a story from the Washington Post. From Black Friday to parking lot pop-ups, five ways holiday shopping will change. Analysts expect retailers to begin rolling out deals before Halloween and consumers to gravitate to larger, more expensive toys. The global pandemic and economic crisis have reshaped nearly every aspect of American life, and the holiday season will be no different. Retailers are reimagining a shopping experience that has long hinged on Black Friday doorbuster deals and shelves of impulse buys. This year, analysts say, they are rethinking what they want to sell and how. The stakes are higher than ever. More than a dozen major retailers have already filed for bankruptcy during the pandemic, and many others are at risk of running out of cash if sales don't pick up soon. And persuading cash-strapped Americans, including nearly 30 million who are collecting unemployment benefits, to splurge on clothes, toys, and electronics will be tougher than usual. Here are five ways holiday shopping will be different this year. Closed on Thanksgiving. After years of kicking off Black Friday sales before the turkey went into the oven, a number of the nation's largest retailers now plan to stay shut on Thanksgiving Day. Walmart led the charge when it announced last month that all 4,750 U.S. stores would close on the holiday for the first time in more than 30 years. Target, Best Buy, Dick's Sporting Goods, and Kohl's quickly followed, citing safety concerns and consumers' growing reliance on online shopping. "We know this has been a trying year, and our associates have stepped up," John Furner, president of Walmart U.S., said in a statement. "We hope they will enjoy a special Thanksgiving Day at home with their loved ones." Thanksgiving Day openings, which have become increasingly popular in the past decade, have drawn scrutiny from workers' rights groups, who say employees are having to forego a family holiday for corporate profits. This year's changes, analysts say, are likely to change the tradition for good. "We can all agree that, so far, 2020 has turned out differently than what we might have expected," Best Buy said in announcing its decision. "And now the holiday season, including Thanksgiving Day, is going to look different too." Holiday sales will begin much earlier. Retailers will roll out deals sooner, before Halloween. Target kicks off holiday sales in October, upping the ante for retailers in the race to rack up sales during the all-important fourth quarter. The three-month period can easily account for 30 to 40% of a company's annual sales. Let's face it. Historically, deal hunting and holiday shopping can mean crowded events, and this isn't a year for crowds, Target said on its site. "That's why our biggest holiday deals will be available earlier than ever, so you can shop safely and conveniently without worrying about missing out on deals that usually come later in the season." Amazon, meanwhile, postponed its Prime Day sale, which usually happens in July. It's mulling October, according to CNBC, a shift that analysts say will put more pressure on competitors to offer their best holiday deals much earlier. Note, Jeff Bezos, the founder and chief executive of Amazon, owns the Washington Post. "Everything has changed, and retailers are having to reinvent themselves," said Marie Driscoll, a managing director at the retail advisory firm CoreSight Research. "The deals will start in October, and retailers will re-up week after week. They'll have one limited edition on week one, and week two, it'll be something else so they can get consumers to keep buying." Outdoor markets and parking lot pop-ups. Retailers have spent millions building up their websites with virtual try-on capabilities and other features during the pandemic. But analysts say it will also be important for them to find ways to safely accommodate consumers who want to browse and buy in person. Shoppers at South Coast Plaza in Costa Mesa, California, can scour the latest wares from more than 200 brands, including Alexander McQueen, Fendi, and Valentino, at the mall's newly built open-air suites on top of its parking garage. Customers must make appointments and wear masks while they shop. Similar outdoor markets, parking lot pop-ups, and sidewalk stalls are likely to crop up in other U.S. cities in the coming weeks as retailers look for ways to replicate the in-store experience in lower-risk settings. Pre-COVID, there was a lot of real-world discovery. People would go to stores to browse and make a mental note of things they wanted to buy, either for themselves or others, said Liad Agman, chief executive of Dynamic Yield, which provides digital customer experience services to retailers. Now that discovery is going to have to take place differently. Fewer experiences, more traditional gifts. After years of splurging on experiences like travel and entertainment, analysts say they expect gift givers to return to basics. In the past couple of years, we've seen a significant shift to gifting experiences, sporting events, trips, concerts, said Natalie Kotliger, head of the retail practice at consulting firm BDO. This year, we're going to be moving away from that, back to more traditional gifts like electronics and toys. Many Americans have moved away from gifting objects, she said, either out of concerns about consumerism and their environmental footprint, or simply wanting to create more meaningful memories. But all of that will be more difficult to maintain this year, as family gatherings, holiday get-togethers, and other outings are scaled back by the pandemic. Instead, analysts predict, more people will be sending small gifts to family and friends by mail, or skip presents altogether. Office traditions like Secret Santa and White Elephants exchanges are also likely to fall by the wayside, as much of the workforce continues to operate from home. Larger, more expensive toys. Overall, toy sales have fallen about 20% at MGA Entertainment, the giant behind popular brands like LOL Surprise and Bratz Dolls. But there's one notable exception. It's Little Tykes line, where sales of ride-on toys, trampolines, and $1,600 playscapes have nearly tripled in recent weeks, according to chief executive Isaac Larian. Families aren't going to the movies or the theater or to Disneyland, so they're using that money for entertainment at home, Larian said. Whether it's slides, bouncers, or playhouses, we can't keep them in stock. Larian expects that trend to continue into the holiday season. MGA is doubling down on multi-use toys for the holidays, including the Toby, a $55 smartwatch that takes selfies, counts steps, and comes with augmented reality games, he said. Also on the decline are what Larian calls shut-up toys. These are small impulse buys, the kind a harried parent at the supermarket might spend $5 to keep my child quiet while I shop. Nobody is buying those anymore, he said. It's all about how long will this toy keep my kid occupied. And now for our remaining 20 minutes, we'll bring you some pre-recorded reports. The first two are Texas-based. From the Texas Tribune, we have columnist Ross Ramsey narrating his column, Analysis, Voting in Texas is Different from Other Places. It's a Hassle.
This is Ross Ramsey's Unconventional Wisdom, brought to you by Discover Downtown Luxury at Fairmont Austin. Experience lavishly appointed rooms, exquisite dining, and sweeping views of the sparkling skyline.
This is Ross Ramsey from the Texas Tribune. Today's column, Voting in Texas is Different from Other Places. It's a Hassle. If the folks in charge wanted everybody in Texas to vote, they would remove every real and imagined obstacle to voting. They do not. They are not. And that makes perverse sense. It's unreasonable to expect elected officials to change the system that got them elected. If you're winning a game every time, you probably don't want to change the rules, unless that is you see a threat to your continued dominance. If you've been winning elections year in and year out, why would you want to change the complexion of the electorate by inviting new people whose loyalties haven't been tested? That makes analysis of any new voting idea pretty simple. Does it make it easier to vote? Does it bring in more of the people who are supposed to be participating in a democracy? Is anyone who ought to be included being unfairly kept out? Are the elections set up properly and is every vote promptly counted? President Donald Trump inspired that last question with his suggestion that new funding for the Postal Service proposed in the latest negotiations for federal COVID-19 relief would make it easier for people to vote by mail, you know, the way the president himself votes. Quote, "Now they need that money in order to make the post office work, so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots," Trump said in a Thursday interview on the Fox Business Network. "Now, if we don't make a deal, that means they don't get the money," he said. "That means they can't have universal mail-in voting. They just can't have it." Texas doesn't offer vote by mail to everyone. You can vote absentee by mail if you're going to be out of your home county during the elections, if you're disabled, jailed, or 65 years old or older. Fear of voting in person during a pandemic doesn't count as a disability, as the courts have said. Even if you do qualify for a mail ballot in Texas, watch those deadlines. Election officials have to have your application in their possession by October 23rd, just days before the November 3rd election. With slow mail deliveries, that's pressing your luck. You send an application, they send a ballot, you vote and send it back. Even in good times, that's tight. The USPS warned Texas and other states on Friday that it can't guarantee delivery of a late crush of mail ballots. In other words, the later the vote, the greater the chance it won't be counted. The early voter gets the franchise. Applications for mail ballots are available now from the Texas Secretary of State or your local elections office, or maybe your party. The Texas Democratic Party is sending out 815,000 vote-by-mail applications to voters. That's a lot, but keep it in perspective. Nearly 9 million Texans voted in the last presidential election, including 3.9 million who voted for the Democratic ticket of Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine. Texas Republicans are with the president, quite literally, worrying loudly about the possibility that fraudulent voting by mail is as common as cornflakes, and also making sure that their own vote-by-mail operations are turning out their voters. If the law allowed the parties to promote voting by mail during the coronavirus pandemic, and if the post office and election officials were in shape to keep up with it, there would be millions more applications on their way to Texas adults. That's a prominent stumbling block, but Texas is full of them. You can't register to vote online, and you can't register at all for this year's general election after October 5th. Texas requires voters to carry government-issued photo identification, a security measure that has survived court challenges but not criticism that it's an unnecessary complication designed to intimidate and impede voters. It's not like that everywhere. Some states allow voters to register to vote on Election Day. Most don't require excuses or extra qualifications from voters who want to vote by mail. Some simply send ballots to all of their citizens who then cast votes by mail or by dropping their ballots in secure public boxes where they can be gathered and counted. It's like they're trying to make it easy. This is Ross Ramsey. Thanks for listening.
And here's our second Texas-based story, this from the Texas Standard today. A collective sigh of relief. Army team fights staff burnout at San Antonio's Baptist Medical Center.
You're listening to the Texas Standard.
About 600 military medical personnel have been deployed around Texas to help hospitals keep up with the demand for bed space, staff, and supplies. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame paid a visit to San Antonio's Baptist Medical Center to see how an Army team works to fight against COVID-19.
Heart check for D room 453.
Army nurse Mika Carafi has developed an almost bat-like sense of hearing since she arrived at Baptist Medical Center in July. She works in a COVID ICU where different machines sound alarms almost constantly.
So you get attuned to, oh, that's a feeding pump. Whose feeding pump is going off? And then you're like, oh, that's an IV pump. Okay, where is that? And so you walk around the unit looking to see whose pump is going off so that you can make sure.
Carafi is one of 23 Army medical personnel deployed to Baptist to help the hospital cope with coronavirus patients who flooded in after Memorial Day. The 32-year-old lives in a nearby hotel and works 12-hour shifts.
Before we even came in, we had heard that the nurses were taking 4 ICU patients, which is a lot. Normally, ICU nurses take 1 to 2 patients.
We basically knew from our command team that it was a hot zone.
That's Shadia Leal, who's also on the Army team here. She's a preventive medicine specialist who was deployed to Iraq and Seattle during that city's COVID crisis. Part of her job is making sure medical staff around Baptist have proper PPE and that they're following protocol when it comes to infection control.
On one of my first days here, I was able to go into the COVID unit, and you can see a little bit of the fear in the patient's eye because COVID is just such a scary disease.
When the team got to San Antonio, they found the hospital stretched thin, its layout and staff having shifted to accommodate COVID patients at different stages of the disease. Connie Thigpen is Baptist's ICU director, and she remembers when the Army arrived.
It was a collective sigh of relief. They have aided so much in not only the physical load, but the mental load, the emotional load, just by sharing in that need to care for these patients in this COVID population.
Army ICU nurses have taken on 20 shifts a week, sometimes caring for 3 to 4 COVID patients at a time. The Army also sent 2 internal medicine doctors, an infectious disease specialist, and a pulmonary critical care physician, along with other medical staff. Their presence has enabled Baptist to nearly double its ICU capacity, from 30 beds to 56. And they're helping prevent burnout, which the hospital's chief medical officer, Lynette Watkins, says is a big issue.
Particularly with a pandemic that is going to continue to go on for a while. So in addition to being able to expand staffed beds, the influx of our colleagues also affords our physicians, nurses, and ancillary support staff a bit of rest and downtime.
Code blue and 809 cancel. Your attention, please.
That's always a good thing. Yeah.
COVID admissions to Baptist are down since the Army team showed up, but the hospital is still nearly full with COVID and non-COVID patients. ICU head nurse Connie Thigpen is anticipating the worst.
Because I think that we're far from being over. We may be in somewhat of a lull statewide right now, but I certainly hope people don't see that and gain a false sense of security from that. Because we have so many other challenging things coming up with reopening of school, flu season, so many unknowns.
Despite that, the Army's deployment to Baptist could end as early as September, according to one hospital official. The Army wasn't able to confirm that. Army Captain and ICU nurse Mika Karafi, who's never been to a combat zone, says working in a civilian hospital has caused her to adjust her expectations for her military career.
We'd always heard about supporting the civilian missions, but it just wasn't very prevalent. And we talk about that frequently within our group, that like things are changing with how we're deployed.
Karafi says she's ready to fulfill her mission, no matter what it looks like or where it takes her.
It's just a different battlefield for the day, you know?
I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Now here's a report from NPR. As many of us, especially in Texas, are doing right now, we're staying inside and cranking down the air conditioner. Pandemic electric bills are searing hot as families stay home. Here's this report.
So more than 3 million homes here in California could lose power during rolling blackouts. The power outages were ordered to ease pressure on the state's electric grid during a heat wave. It also comes as tens of millions of people are working from home nationwide, which means residential demand for power has soared. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
Leandro Ramirez lives in Glendale, Arizona, where the high temperature in August can easily climb to 110 degrees.
I can go outside and scramble eggs on the sidewalk. Like, that's crazy.
Air conditioning is essential. Ordinarily, the AC at Ramirez's house would get a break during the middle of the day when she goes off to work at a trucking company and her kids go to school. But not this summer.
Now, it's running a constant 75 degrees every day because everybody's home, you know, and sitting in front of my laptop all day, and the kids with their laptops, it just starts to get progressively warmer in that room every hour.
Ramirez says her electric bill in July was $385. Her 4 teenagers just started back to online school from home, so she worries this month's bill will be even higher.
We have a very full house. There's always a computer on, and there's always an Xbox playing, and there's always a TV left on.
Economist Steve Sakala of Tufts University has been studying electric consumption as a window on how families and businesses are weathering the pandemic. In ordinary times, home electricity use perks up in the morning as people wake up and start the coffee, then drops during the workday. Sakala says the coronavirus has upended that predictable pattern.
People are sleeping in later into the day, and it's like a smooth increase over the course of the day because they're at home. And I think people are staying up a little bit later, too.
So far, the spike in home electric use has not made up for the drop in commercial and industrial demand. But the gap is narrowing as home air conditioners are working overtime. Lisa Vroman shares a tiny apartment in Philadelphia with her boyfriend, a dog, and a cat. It seemed like plenty of space until they were all staying there virtually around the clock. Suddenly, those vaulted ceilings were not so attractive.
The ceilings make it feel like you're in a big space, but that's expensive to keep cool.
Vroman, who's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, says her electric bill in June was more than double last year's. She feels fortunate she can afford the increase, but she knows it's a real hardship for many people, especially those who've lost their jobs.
If you have no income and you now need to have your family there all the time, like, it's got to be expensive.
Vroman noticed her water bill has gone up too, perhaps from all the extra hand washing. Sean Chambers, who runs the water department in Greeley, Colorado, says residential customers there are using 30% more water this year than last. He blames much of the increase on this year's hot, dry weather, but suspects the pandemic is also playing a part.
People were certainly at home using water in ways they had not previously.
One other residential bill that's gone sky high? Wi-Fi. Leandra Ramirez says since the pandemic began, her family keeps going over its data limit, and she's had to pay their internet service provider for extra gigabytes.
For the first couple months, they weren't charging people for overages, but apparently in their world, the pandemic ended in June. So that's something I reached out to them about and said, hey, we're all still stuck at home. Did you miss the memo?
Ramirez expects to remain stuck at home for the foreseeable future. There are trade-offs for all those extra expenses, she says. She likes being able to spend more time with her kids, and with no work clothes to wash, she is saving a bundle on laundry. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Our final report looks at something we've been hearing about for weeks, for months. Emphasis on wearing masks. Doctors and medical officials, retailers, universities, begging people to wear masks. Some just won't do it. This report brings in behavioral economists on why some people resist wearing masks.
All right. Usually when someone offers a simple solution to a big problem, we're thrilled, right? We just do that thing. But in this pandemic, one simple solution has become really controversial. Masks. Mary Childs from our Planet Money podcast wanted to understand why people are resisting masks and if there was anything we can do to convince them.
There's a field of economics dedicated to solving gnarly problems. Problems that arise when humans choose not to do things that are in their own best interests. Behavioral economics. Behavioral economists have helped America smoke less, save more for retirement, drink and drive less, and practice safer sex. Mask wearing is in the collective best interest, but in a pandemic, collective interests become individual ones really fast. So we hoped that maybe behavioral economists could help us out here. So we called one, Sion Banot at Swarthmore.
Unfortunately, I think you've hit on the central question of our time, right? Why are people resistant to pro-social behavior?
He says there are a few things about a pandemic that make it hard for us to grasp. For starters, salience. We tend to look around us to what we can see and feel for guidance.
The cues that you're getting are not, you know, that it's this devastating disease per se. Most of us walk around our neighborhoods and people don't, you know, aren't falling down on the street and there aren't ambulances all over the place.
Then we take whatever we see and over-extrapolate. We mistake the local for the national. This is the law of small numbers. But we also struggle with large numbers, like exponential growth. We hear there are 12 cases and we can't fathom that that could be 12,000 in a few weeks. So when corners of America untouched by the virus started getting lectures from urban America, where the virus was raging, Banot says this finger-wagging sparked what's called psychological reactance.
Which is that when people perceive external constraints on their freedom coming from the outside, they are prone to push back against those constraints.
Which is in part how masks became a politicized symbol, a signal of in-group identity. Instead of health or science, for some it became about individual rights.
So if you walk up to someone not wearing a mask and yell at them, that can entrench them even more, right? That can make them even more resistant to the behavior change. So, you know, I certainly think that's one thing I would suggest that we not do.
We asked Banot if behavioral economics had suggestions for what we should do. Like, say the Planet Money podcast wanted to make our own PSA to encourage mask wearing. Benoit mentioned one particularly powerful motivator, especially when trying to get people to act in the collective interest, our reputation in a community. Every community has norms. Like when you are standing in any line, you just don't cut, mostly because you don't want to look like a jerk. So we have to establish a norm and then communicate it effectively. The message has to be unambiguous, yes or no. It sounds obvious, but it's something we really messed up with masks. At first it was, don't wear them. And then it became, do you have a ratty t-shirt that you could wear on your face? All this made it hard to know what to do, much less what norm to enforce. And the message matters. Research shows that in times of uncertainty, people lean on their social circles for information, or respected local leaders. So maybe the mask message should come from local doctors or nurses, or for kids going back to school, Big Bird.
See means cover, cover your face.
Lastly, emotion can help, except when it goes too far. Research shows if you make people too scared, with no sense that they can solve the problem, they fritz out and don't act. So behavioral economics says our PSA needs to be clear, delivered by a trusted messenger, and use emotion, but not too much. And we figured the people who don't want to wear masks love their families, right? So we asked America's mom of the hit TV show Family Guy if she would record one for us.
Hi, I'm Lois Griffin, proud wife, full-time mother, and one-time mayor of Quahog. Two of those things are true. Now, I understand that you have been out and about not wearing your mask. What are you doing? Seriously, what are you doing? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. The sooner you wear your mask, the sooner this thing will be over and we can get back to business as usual. Wear your mask. Wear your mask. Let people live. Huh? Take care of each other.
Mary Childs, NPR News.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, August 18th, from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up next, the national news from USA Today. At 3 o'clock, it's our local newspaper broadcast. And today we'll be trying to catch up on stories from Monday that we didn't get to yesterday, as well as today's articles. And here are a few of those that we'll be reading. From the Midland Reporter Telegram, MISD Board to evaluate Superintendent Riddick. Filing period for local races ends. City reports 3 people die in structure fire. MISD reports at least 3,000 students sign up for online academy. And then from today's Midland paper, all Midland ISD seats on ballot will be contested. City reports Monday cases continue daily drop. From the Odessa American, veterans event will be back in 21. Safety a priority during back to school. Mail-in ballot rules unchanged. U.S. Senator John Cornyn visits the West Texas Food Bank. Jovan running to be Odessa's mayor. And 60 cases reported at nursing home. Those are some of the stories that we'll be reading this afternoon beginning at 3 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, of course, we'll have the... Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio... USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 91 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 70s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Michelle Obama goes high. GOP's John Kasich blasts Trump and other top moments from the DNC's opening night. Night one made history, literally. The opening night of the 2020 Democratic National Convention was unlike others before it. Performers and speakers gathered virtually, coming to Americans' living rooms from states across the nation amid the coronavirus pandemic. The event largely centered on COVID-19, racial justice, and testimonials from Democrats, including former First Lady Michelle Obama, who called former Vice President Joe Biden a man of compassion who would unite the country. The evening also featured remarks from Republicans such as former presidential candidate John Kasich, who are now backing Biden. Here's a rundown of some of the top moments. Michelle Obama on Trump. He is clearly in over his head. Former First Lady Michelle Obama headlined the first day of speeches by saying the presidential election would reveal the character